Rebecca Rose was one of those girls in high school who fell behind in math. She eventually dropped out of school altogether. Years later, when she was in her 30s, she went back to school, and she met a teacher who offered to help.
I think my grade level was like 2.3 or 3.0. You know, it's like third grade math. I was totally beyond addition and subtraction and, you know, basic stuff. I was a math illiterate. And she said, well, yeah, we can help you.
Rebecca did get it. She went on to a college-level math course she never would have imagined she'd understand. And now she is teaching math to others who dropped out.
And I started working with this student, and they started getting it. And it was like, oh, this is wonderful. I'm glad I can help you.
Add one dropout, return to the power of school, carry the math, and X equals the kind of change you only read about in books. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Story.
The Story is produced by North Carolina Public Radio, WUNC. It's co-produced and distributed by American Public Media.
We're getting to that time when high school students are wrapping up their year, assessing their grades, and wondering what lies ahead. Many will go on to college, and many more will drop out. It's expected that this year more than 1 million students will drop out. My guest today was one of them. Rebecca Rose says that her problem started the year when she got sick. She missed a lot of school, and she fell behind, particularly in math.
We had done some multiplication, you know, in fourth grade, I guess, or third grade, whenever. They teach math so differently now that kids are doing it in first grade that we were adding and subtracting,
right.
You know. And I got sort of left behind, and I never memorized my multiplication table. And I missed some of those first introductions to, like, fractions and decimals. Decimals I could do okay with as we went on, because decimals are money. But fractions were just, like, these bizarre things that, you know, I didn't deal with, unless I was cooking. It's like 3/4 of a cup. Okay, yeah. I can read 3/4 and I can.
But what's half of 3/4 of a cup? No, I better look that
yeah.
up.
Yeah. Well, no, and that's, and I literally have to find somebody to help me do that. I couldn't. Yeah.
So you're then at that, you're always feeling like you're struggling to keep up?
After that, yeah, absolutely. I just felt, you know, lost. Even when I could do the math, I couldn't do it quickly. And then I was sort of made to feel stupid because I couldn't do it quickly and I couldn't do it in my head.
And the thing is, at that age, in that grade level, that would be the only subject that you'd fall behind in and stay behind in. You could skip one book that was read in English class,
right.
Or, you know, the study of the history of Peru in social studies and pick up with, you know, Europe in the next term. But
right.
You're missing like a few bricks in the foundation, right?
Well, you know, when you learn math, you have this pyramid. And at that foundation is adding, subtracting, multiplying, and dividing. And if your foundation has holes in it, anything you try to put on top of it's going to be shaky. And yeah, I was missing, I had big holes in my foundation. You know, my anything I tried to put on top of it fell off pretty quick because there was nothing to hold it up.
When you went home at the end of the day and talked to your mother about this, what did she say?
My mom would say, well, I understand. I don't do math either. I can't do math. And you know, it's hard. You just have to keep trying.
But did that give you an excuse to think, you know, it's genetic.
Oh, yeah, exactly. Because my dad is really good at math and, you know, it was like, well, ask your father to help you. You know, but it's like, well, Ma, you know, you get through life without doing math. You know, I want to do the same thing. It was an excuse. Oh, Mom can't do math. I can't do math. It's genetic. Yeah, it's natural.
When Rebecca Rose was starting her junior year in high school, she dropped out altogether, in part because of her trouble with math. She did get her GED, but soon after she left to sell books and records. When she was in her 30s, she decided she wanted something more, but she found math standing in her way once again.
I was working retail and nights and weekends. You know, I've always been a reader. I've always considered myself to be fairly smart, fairly bright. I had friends who were going back to school. We're talking about, it's like, wow, that sounds so great, you know, and oh, I miss that environment. And, you know, was trying to figure out a way that I could get through college without taking any math, which was becoming more and more apparent that I might not be able to do that. Everybody had to take college algebra or low-level college math, you know, which to me was over the moon. There was no way.
And had you, I was going to say, you decided at this point that you just couldn't do this stuff.
Oh, right? Yeah. So I talked to an admissions officer, and they said, there's this GED program, and they'll help you with math. You don't have to get a GED. You can just work on one thing or another.
And you're saying, I have my GED.
And they, right? Exactly. It's like, well, I have my GED. Aren't they going to think that it's weird? And they said, well, we've sent students like you this way before, and it's worked for them. Why don't you go check it out? Give it a try. And so I went, and when you go in, you take an assessment test, and it sort of gives you an approximate grade level, what level you're working on. And I took this test, and I think my grade level was like 2.3 or 3.0, you know, it's like third grade math is
you're
what I could do.
Adding and subtracting, period.
Then. Adding is a little basic multiplication, really simple division.
Yeah.
Really simple division.
Was this disheartening for you? Were you thinking?
Oh, yeah. I was like, okay, that's worse than I thought, you know?
I knew it was bad, but.
I knew it was going to be bad, but wow. And, but you know, you think about it, that's about where I started feeling that left behind feeling was fourth grade. And then of course it went back from there. And she said, well, yeah, we can help you. And she started me out with addition and subtraction. Okay. You're good with that. You know, we did lots of long addition and long subtraction. Okay. You're good with that. We know you can do that. Multiplication. Okay. You can do this. You're very slow. Here's a multiplication table. I suggest you learn it.
Which, how old would you have been at this time, Rebecca?
I was in my 30s. 31 or 32.
Yeah.
You know, you hear about people, illiterate people who can't read. I was totally beyond addition and subtraction and, you know, basic stuff. I was a math illiterate.
And what was your motivation at the time? Were you thinking, I'm never going to do this? Or, you know, I can do that. What were you thinking?
Well, I definitely thought, well, I'm never going to do this, but I really wanted to go back to college. And you had to have the math to do anything else. So it's like, okay, if I can get myself to a point where I can get through a math class and get a, you know, a C or a D, then I can enjoy the classes that I really like. But once I started learning it, I started saying, hey, you know, this could be useful. I can go to a restaurant and figure out what the tip is. I can look at something on sale that's a third off and say, oh, well, that's going to be about this much off. I still don't think I'd ever use algebra or anything that I learned farther than that, but it might help with my taxes or, you know, something like that.
You're listening to The Story. I'm Dick Gordon. So Rebecca Rose is in her early 30s, still doing math at a third grade level and wondering how she'll get ahead. She found the support she needed in a GED teacher.
She was very gentle with me, and she saw the fear. I had fear. I was afraid of math. And she saw the fear. She kind of eased me into it. And from the very beginning, from looking at a picture of a pizza with pieces cut in it, you know, we bought a pizza. It has 8 pieces. We ate 3. How much pizza is left? And then we moved into decimals. And then we moved to percents. And it's like, oh, and they're related. When you understand one, it helps you with the other ones, you know. And when I would be embarrassed that I was looking at pieces of pizza and counting them, she says, that's where everybody starts.
Yeah.
And she was saying, and now when you order pizza at home, you can do your own fractions. And it's like, oh, yeah, you can figure out how much you have left for breakfast in the morning. She was just saying, you can do this, and this is why it works, and this is how it makes sense.
So how far did you go? How lit up about math did you get?
Well, I worked really, really hard. I mean, I was like, give me homework, give me homework. I need stuff to take home. And I would go home and I would work at night after work. I'd be doing math and I got pretty excited about it. You know, they'd test me along the way. And I was like, oh, you moved from 3 to 6. And I was like, this is so cool.
And are you getting now into geometry and algebra?
Not a lot, but yeah, basic stuff. And for the GED, that's all they teach, you know, really basic geometry and algebra. So she finally said to me one day, she's like, I think you're ready. You can take the remedial math class at the university. And I was like, really? Are you sure?
Rebecca Rose passed that remedial math class and got almost all the requirements for a college degree, but the advanced math class she needed was holding her back. She failed algebra 3 times. And eventually a friend told her to try the one called finite math. And that's where Rebecca moved beyond just passing math and began to actually enjoy it.
It was like fun. It was like little puzzles. And I liked puzzles. I liked, you know, crossword puzzles and word puzzles. But this was, okay, this is a number puzzle, but this is okay. And, you know, we did things like probability. And it was like, oh, this is really interesting. And my major was geography. You know, so I was doing some work on numbers and how they work and things like that. And so looking at probability, I was like, oh, that's cool. That's actually almost useful.
And at any point along this little track, did you stop and say, I'm the girl who couldn't get fourth grade math. I'm the one who tested third grade at the GED class, and look at me now.
Yeah. And when I got an A in finite math, I went out to dinner. I took myself out to dinner. I was like, yes, I am the girl who couldn't do math. And I got an A in this class, and I loved it. I loved the class. So bizarre, you know. Wasn't planning to become a math major or anything, but...
And when you look back on it now, Rebecca, do you think that it had more to do with that summer class and that teacher, or was it your own persistence? What kept you going?
Well, there was some beauty to the numbers. There was some beauty to the numbers and the way that things worked. And it always worked the same way every time. There was things that I could see that I could possibly use.
But there's a code, too, as well. And there's, you know, if you know the code, it's kind of like knowing a secret code.
Yeah.
And you're part of the club and this is
yeah,
this cool.
Exactly. Yeah, there is definitely some of that. So there was some beauty to it that surprised me.
Rebecca Rose wound up with an A in finite math and a college degree, never imagining that one day she'd turn around and start teaching GED courses. And that she'd be teaching math to high school dropouts, just like her. I'm Dick Gordon from American Public Media. This is The Story. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Story. It used to be that one pressing concern among educators was how to get girls interested in math. I remember that all the time I was in school, it was kind of accepted wisdom that it was the boys who did well in math class. But looking back, I think it was more a matter of tell the girls that they're not good at math, and many of them will believe it. These days we know it's not true, but Rebecca Rose says she gave up on her math skills when she was a teenager. She dropped out of high school. She went back to school when she was in her 30s to get her college degree. One day, a friend asked if she would help out with a GED class that he was teaching, and Rebecca soon worked her way from volunteer up to lead teacher. But that fear of math was still with her. She helped students with reading and writing.
And finally, there came a day where someone really needed help with math, and it's like, okay, I can't help you tonight, but let me take this book home, and I'll review it all, and I'll help you next time. And I started working with a student, and they started getting it. And it was like, oh, this is wonderful. I'm glad I can help you. And that's the thing, is the more you teach it, the more you learn, the more it comes back, and the more you use it, like with anything.
But there's a confidence thing, too, right? When you believe that you
yes.
can teach it,
yes.
you're better
yeah, at teaching it. Yeah, and that took a while. And especially the more intensive upper-level GED math. And GED math, there's enough to it that it does build a bridge that someone can take the GED and then go on to college. And maybe they'll need remedial math, but they can get it.
The other cool thing about what you're doing now is the variety of students that you'd be teaching. I mean, unlike it being a bunch of... you know, kids who are all 14 and trying to get to the next grade, you must have a tremendous variety in the classes that you're teaching.
It's incredible. I have students that are, the youngest you can be in a GED class is 16 and a half. You have to be 16 and a half and out of school 6 months, which essentially means you have to drop out, wait 6 months and as soon as you turn 16. And then I have one student that I'm pretty sure is in his 70s. And his wife is also coming, and she's in her 60s.
You're teaching them both at the same time?
Yeah. Yeah.
Is this just like an adult ed thing for them, or why are they doing it?
They've never had time to do it, and now they do, and they're raising their, I think, their great-grandchild, or helping raise their great-grandchild, and they want to help him with his schoolwork, and so they're coming in doing it.
How are they doing?
They're doing really well. They're working on division, and they're getting it. It's been a long time since they've done anything like that. I have a grandmother and her granddaughter who are coming.
Who's motivating who?
It's a little bit of both. A little bit of both. The granddaughter is very bright, and she's taken all her tests but one, or maybe two. The grandmother's really bright and has taken all her tests but one. She's like me. She was terrified of math. She had to start with the basics, and she's working her way up in the math.
Let me ask you something. When you're doing that kind of teaching, do you see the very instant when someone gets it?
Many times. It's a look in the eye. It's a glow almost. Their body changes. You know, it's like you get that sort of hunched feeling when they're trying to figure it out, and it's like they open up.
You just set your shoulders back.
Yeah. They open up, and it's like, oh, okay. So, yeah, it's definitely a light bulb. You can see those light bulbs, and that's a beautiful
thing. I was going to say, what's that like?
It's a beautiful thing because it's like, this is why I do this job.
Rebecca Rose now finds herself dealing directly with one of the pressing educational issues today, how to encourage the millions and millions of people who've dropped out of high school. She says it takes a lot of patience.
There was a student in one of my classes, and we'd been working on rounding decimals.
Okay, what's that?
Rounding decimals. So you have a decimal number and you want to make it a whole number. So,
okay, all right. So 7.9 rounds to 8.
Yeah, exactly. Okay. Yeah, 3.5. Is that closer to 3 or is it closer to $3 or closer to $4?
Is this on the test?
No,
I'm just kidding.
Actually, some of it is. Yeah. Because there's questions that ask you to do things like estimate and stuff. And she was struggling with, oh, it's in the tenths place and which number am I changing? And so I kept explaining to her. It's like, okay, is $3.79 closer to $3 or $4? Is $2.13 closer to $2 or $3? And it was like, oh. And I was talking about bills. I said, when you're trying to figure out what you're going to pay at the end of the month for your bills, you don't say I owe $3.27 and $8.49. You say I'm going to owe about $3, about $5. She's like, oh, yeah, I do that. I said, you're rounding decimals. I am? Uh-huh. And she just lit up. I can do that. Yeah. And it was just beautiful. And then I started asking the class questions, and she was wanting to answer every one because I can do this.
Right.
And she was getting the answers right.
I mean, I get what it's like for her. What's it like for you to see that?
For me, it's a triumph. I'm sure I light up too, because their triumph over whatever it is glows back at me, and I feel like, wow, I helped somebody do something.
I'm Dick Gordon. You're listening to The Story. There's something else that Rebecca Rose has going for her, and that's the ability to tell her students that she, too, was once a dropout. Well, as she puts it, a math illiterate.
I often hear your show, when I'm driving home, and I was talking of, what's your story? And it's like, I told my story again tonight, And I usually tell it almost not every class. Once a class gets to know me and is sort of stable, but when I have new students or when I'm working with someone who's having a particularly bad night, things aren't clicking, things aren't working, or when I, have people that are really working on something, it's like I can say, yeah, I remember when I learned this, when I was in my 30s, and it was very hard, and I had to practice a lot, and I had to do it over and over again, but it will stick, because that's part of it. It's like, even when I was taking math, it was like, you'd go to class, and they'd go through, and they'd walk you through, and it'd be like, oh, yeah, okay, I can see what's going on, and I'd go home, and I'd be like,
yeah, I know, me too.
What was that? The numbers look the same, but I don't have any clue what to do with them. And through my own experience, I know that what you have to do is kind of do it over and over and over and over. And then it will stick. And in this world where we kind of want instant gratification in a lot of things, you have to really want it to stick for it to stick. But I have seen students that started with where I was,
yeah,
around where I was, a little lower, a little higher, and gone on and passed their GED math class test with no problem and been shocked,
You must get some, take some pride in that.
Oh, yeah, absolutely, absolutely. Because, you know, I've been there, and I've had students come back and say, yeah, I took a class in math. I did good. It's like, cool.
Rebecca Rose joined me here in our Chapel Hill studio. Once she heard that we use this little space on the radio dial to figure out what we can learn from hearing other people tell their stories, she wrote in to tell me hers. And you can do the same thing. You can find me at thestory.org. That's a website. Or you can call me at 1-888-966-9862, 1-888-966-9862. Or take the time to write me a letter. You can send it to The Story, 120 Friday Center Drive, Chapel Hill, North Carolina. Zip code is 27517. My next guest tells a story that underlines in powerful and personal terms the importance of one key sense, the sense of smell. It's perhaps the one of our senses that we most often take for granted. Well, Molly Birnbaum didn't. She had set her sights on a career as a chef. She loved to cook. She lived for that swirl of smells in a kitchen, the different aromas of herbs and spices. And then one day after an accident, Molly held her chin over a steaming piece of apple crisp and realized she'd lost her sense of smell.
I had some friends there, and my family was there, and everyone was oohing and aahing over the smell of the crisp. And I remember thinking, this is weird. I can't smell anything. And even when they held it under my nose, I couldn't smell a thing. It was just the heat of the steam.
Molly's experience, her description of losing her sense of smell, changed her life completely. And it's a reminder for us of how often we actually rely on our noses. You see, Molly first got this idea of becoming a chef when she was traveling overseas in her junior year at college. She saw something in the way that people ate and the role that food plays in people's lives. It started when she was teaching in Namibia.
The village that I taught in was very depressed and poor, especially the family that I lived with, and they didn't take joy in the food that they had because there just really weren't many options.
What were you eating then?
Some meat, maize meal patties, like boiled maize meal. And it wasn't horrible at all. I think it was more the people that I lived with there were depressed. They were going through a very difficult time. And that kind of came out in the culture of their dinner table. And that really came to light for me because I went straight from there to Florence, Italy to study art. And just going from one extreme to the next, it was jarring and wonderful to see what can happen when people take joy in what they're eating and when it's so imbued with history and culture. Once I was hiking with a friend outside of Florence, and we just stopped at a kind of hole-in-the-wall restaurant, and I remember we ate mussels. It was a small room, and it was just filled with people, all Italians. We were the only Americans there. And I just remember being so happy that I was in this place where there were people who really cared about what they were eating, and we were eating this delicious food, and we were happy, and everyone, you know, was talking to each other. And it was right around then that I became obsessed with food and cooking. And I didn't know that I wanted to be a chef when I was in Italy, but I started taking cooking classes there, and I got so interested in the flavors and the science of the food. And so when I came back to America, I started cooking.
Molly Birnbaum spent her senior year in college testing and perfecting recipes. She actually became a student of the apple pie.
I'd have friends come over every Sunday, and they'd try a different apple pie, and then I'd have them rate it, and we would talk about it. And at the end, I came up with something that it was a conglomeration of everything that I thought was the best.
So tell me what's in it.
That was my...
What's your favorite apple?
Well, I like to combine apples. I think it's good for different textures. Like Granny Smith and Macintosh, I think, were two of the ones that I used in the final one. And I like a little citrus in there and cinnamon. And the crust, I like to have half butter and half shortening.
Any nutmeg?
A little bit of nutmeg, too, yeah. I think that's key.
It was a pretty good pie, was it?
It was a great pie. I still make it. It's wonderful.
And when you decided that you wanted a career as a chef, what did you decide to do? Did you think about getting time in a restaurant?
Yeah. Actually, as soon as I graduated from college, I moved back to Boston where my family is, and I walked into the best restaurant that I knew of, and I pretty much begged for a job as a dishwasher.
Begged for a job as a dishwasher?
Yeah.
This is a very good restaurant, I guess.
In retrospect, I don't really know what I was thinking of, but at the time, working my way up from the very bottom seemed like the best way to really understand how to cook, because I had only really taught myself for fun with apple pies in a very unprofessional kitchen, and I wanted to learn from the best in the best way that I could. So I, you know, brought my resume and I wrote a cover letter, and I think I even wore heels to go to this restaurant and ask the chef to hire me. And he did, as a dishwasher. And that's how I started.
And you took the job.
I took the job, and I loved the job. It was difficult, but...
Did you get close to the kitchen, though, Molly? Or were you washing dishes all the time you were there?
Well, I was washing a lot of dishes, but it was a very small kitchen. There were only 5 people there, including me. And so I got to watch everything that happened. And the chef there taught me from the bottom things that I needed to know in order to cook, in order to taste. And I learned more in the 3 months that I ended up working there than I ever have in all the reading that I've done and all of the practice that I've done for myself.
I'm Dick Gordon. You're listening to The Story. The chef that Molly Birnbaum went to work for, well, one of the first things he taught her was the importance of ingredients, the herbs and the spices, making sure that they're fresh and taking the time to touch them and taste them.
They had these wonderful specialty herbs. And
did they grow the herbs themselves? Or?
No, they got them from nearby farms, maybe 15 different types of herbs, which I had never heard of before, like hyssop and pineapple mint and, I don't know, there's so many. And we would store them in the walk-in refrigerator. And every day when I got there, I would take them out and I would pluck them to have individual leaves because they put them on this small salad. And I used to taste leaves of every type of herb with my eyes closed so I could taste every single herb and test myself and see if I could tell the difference between them.
Did the chef teach you anything about smelling the food or being able to judge it through what you smelled?
Well, that was a big part. It's a big part of eating. Smell really constitutes, I think, around 80% of flavor. Without scent, you can taste the salty, sweet, bitter, and sour that your taste buds pick up. And everything else, every other nuance, subtlety, spice, is through your nose. And so, I mean, learning the different herbs, that was all smell. And learning how to taste what is good and what is, you know, high quality and what is perfectly done, in a large part, that all comes from smell.
And what are the smells that you remember from that kitchen?
Well, I spent a lot of time with the chicken stock, storing it and helping to make it and straining it, which is, you know, the stock that is used in most sauces. It's, like, very flavorful, and it chicken bones and vegetables and meat is just boiled for hours on the stove. I remember the smell of that. It was very strong, and I think I smelled like it even when I wasn't in the restaurant. ¶¶
Molly spent a summer in the kitchen of that Boston restaurant. She loved it, but she was always wondering what the experience meant for her own career. So she applied for and got accepted at the prestigious Culinary Institute of America. But just weeks after Molly left the restaurant, her life changed in a way that she could never have imagined. She was hit by a car. She survived that, but the resulting head injury took her sense of smell and her future as a chef. I'll talk with her about that and what came after in just a moment. I'm Dick Gordon from American Public Media. This is The Story. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Story. Those of us who have the use of all five senses get to imagine how life would change without the use of our eyes or our ears, and we do that. But we rarely think about how life would change if we lost our sense of smell. Molly Birnbaum went through this. She was passionate about cooking. She'd won a coveted spot at the Culinary Institute of America, but then one morning she went out for a jog. She was crossing a highway just as the light turned, and a car flew through the intersection and hit her.
I fractured my skull, I broke my pelvis, I tore the ligaments in my knee, and I really don't remember a couple weeks from that moment.
What do you remember?
I remember moments in the hospital. I remember one of my friends from high school coming, and I remember thinking that I hadn't seen her in a long time, and my mom sitting next to me, and I remember the TV playing cartoons, I remember the bedpans, and then I remember, you know, kind of emerging from the groggy haze of pain medication and a skull fracture in a bed at my mom's house in Boston. They had moved the bed down into the living room, and that's where I was for, you know, a month, 6 weeks afterwards.
Oh, you were lucky to survive this then.
Yeah, I know. I was incredibly, incredibly lucky that I'm totally fine.
Molly didn't know it at the time, but she wasn't totally fine. When she fractured her skull, she lost the ability to smell. In all the days of making it from hospital to home, she didn't know that she lost it until something very familiar came from the kitchen.
Someone had made an apple crisp.
Which is a very familiar smell for you, having made all those pies.
A very familiar smell to me. And I had some friends there, and my family was there, and everyone was oohing and aahing over the smell of the crisp. And I remember thinking, this is weird. I can't smell anything. And even when they held it under my nose, I couldn't smell a thing. It was just the heat of the steam and no smell whatsoever.
And that was the first moment when you realized that something was up with your sense of smell. Even all that time in the hospital with all those sort of eye-watering disinfectant smells.
Yeah. I definitely wasn't really in my mind when I was in the hospital.
You were pretty groggy there, were you?
I was very groggy. I don't think I realized much of anything. And even when I realized that I couldn't smell the apple crisp, I thought it was just a blip. Maybe it was just that moment, and it didn't actually have any long-ranging implications, which I later learned was not the case.
So where did you go from there? Did you start testing your nose, for example?
Yeah. As soon as it started to sink in that I couldn't smell, my dad, who was a doctor, would come over, and he brought bottles of spices and cloves of garlic, and we would just sniff every single one of them, and I couldn't smell anything, and it was very frustrating and sad.
Was it just food smells, Molly? Or, I mean, if he'd opened a bottle of bleach under your nose, were you not going to smell that either?
No, I couldn't smell anything. I mean, there are certain things that are very equated with smell that you can feel, like alcohol, that you can feel that in your nose as well. So I could feel things sometimes, but there was no scent. There was no aroma that I could detect in anything.
What were you thinking?
You know, I'm ever the optimist. I kept on thinking, wow, I hope this comes back before I start at the Culinary Institute. But as time went on and I eventually went to a taste and smell clinic at the University of Connecticut, when they kind of explained what had happened, I realized that it was a much longer term.
What did they tell you?
Well, when I fractured my skull, my brain bounced, basically, in my head. And the olfactory neurons, which snake from your nose through your forehead to your brain, were damaged or severed in the impact. The neural connection between my nose and my brain was damaged. And so I couldn't smell anything. And at the University of Connecticut, they told me that the olfactory neurons are some of the very few in the body that have the tendency to regenerate. So it was possible, but it was very far-fetched that it would actually happen. Or if it would happen, it would take years.
Do you remember coming to the realization that it might not come back?
Yeah, I think it was around Christmas time of that year, so a number of months after the accident. And I had already delayed my acceptance to the CIA a number of times. But around Christmas, I kind of realized that I had to make a different plan.
That must have been hard.
It was. It was very sad to not be able to smell and to not be able to cook the way I wanted to. But at the same time, it made me happy to know what had happened and to know that there was nothing I could do about it. So it was kind of comforting to know what had happened.
I'm Dick Gordon. You're listening to The Story. There's new research coming out all the time about the way that our sense of smell is connected to memory and emotion. Molly Birnbaum was learning this firsthand.
Before I lost my sense of smell, I never thought about smell. But I soon learned without the ability to smell, a lot of the texture of life disappears. I mean, everything has a smell. Every room, every person. Walking down the street, you're hit with smells all the time. I mean, it's part of the wider perception of your world. And though subliminal at times, it's a sense that affects you every moment. And it's tied to memory and it's tied to emotion. And without it, the world kind of fades to black and white. A bit. I mean, not in the moment to moment or even in the day to day, but overall, your experience definitely lacks something without the ability to smell.
What happens to the food that you eat, the whatever you drink? What's the change?
Oh, that's a big change, because without smell, most, if not all, of the flavor of food is gone. And so you can taste on your taste buds the salty, sweet, bitter, and sour. So, for me, food was reduced to temperature and texture.
And does that take all the fun out of it? Is it just fuel at that point?
Yeah. Basically, for me, I had a hard time eating. I mean, coffee turns into hot brown water. Milk is just a really thick liquid. And I put Tabasco sauce on everything because you can feel the spice in your mouth, and even if you can't taste it, it's something different. It's a feeling. So I used so much Tabasco sauce in the beginning, and because I could taste sugar, just the basic sweetness. Ice cream was very appealing because the texture and the temperature is wonderful, and then with the sweet combined, you'd have to go for things that felt nice in your mouth rather than for tastes that you enjoyed.
So if you had a glass of ginger ale, for example, you'd feel the bubbles but no flavor with them, right?
Yeah, you'd feel the bubbles and you'd taste the sugar. But that's about it. All of the subtlety and nuance and everything that makes food interesting in your mouth, is it kind of disappears.
Man, having listened to you describe how much you enjoyed the smell and the preparation of and the eating of food, to have all that taken away, I just can't imagine what its effect was like on you.
It was depressing. Very much. I think at the time I tried just not to think about it, tried to think more about how lucky I was to be alive. But it did have a very concrete change in my life. I couldn't go to culinary school if I couldn't taste.
When you think back to that time now, Molly, where did the depression show?
I think that it showed purely in the fact that I was sad and I was confused and lethargic. And I mean, I was also kind of healing my body. My pelvis was shattered and I had knee surgery and I couldn't walk for a really long time. And I just felt like I was not occupying my body anymore, that it was this foreign, painful object. And, you know, I couldn't understand the world around me like I used to, because I couldn't smell and I couldn't move because it hurt. And so I felt very dislocated for quite some time.
Did you keep testing your nose, you know, picking up something that you knew had a scent and going just to see if there was something there?
Yeah, I definitely did.
And nothing.
I definitely. And there was, for a while, there was nothing.
You're listening to The Story. I'm Dick Gordon. Molly Birnbaum had set her sights on a career as a chef, but after she was hit by a car, she lost her sense of smell and she had to let go of that dream. However, she hadn't completely given up on the kitchen.
As soon as I was more mobile, I decided that I wanted to cook, because I didn't want to let that go. So I was cooking a lot in that time.
Can I just interrupt you for a sec, though?
Yeah.
I mean, it strikes me as odd that you would go back to cooking as someone without a sense of smell. I mean, how did you know what you were cooking was any good?
Well, I think oftentimes it wasn't. But I just...
But they humored you?
They humored me. They were wonderful. I didn't want to give up. I felt like I was, you know, giving up all hope if I decided not to cook at all anymore. I mean, it was something that consumed me. And just stopping completely.
So you were thinking, what, I'm going to do this despite the fact that I can't smell, or I'm going to do this until I can smell again? What was going on inside you?
I don't think I thought about it so concretely. I just knew that I wanted to cook and knew that I wasn't ready to accept the fact that I couldn't. And I baked a lot of cookies and muffins and cakes, everything. I would make multiple course dinners on my crutches in the kitchen. It was a little crazy. My mom used to say that my cooking at that time was erratic at best. But it made me feel better.
So what changed?
Well, one night I was cooking dinner for my mom and her boyfriend, and I was chopping rosemary. I don't even remember what I was making, but for something. And while I was chopping the herb, all of a sudden it hit me that I could smell it. It was this strong, pungent whiff of rosemary. And perhaps if I had not been holding the rosemary, I wouldn't have known exactly what it was, but it was very strong.
What did you do? What'd you think?
Well, it's funny, because smell is so tied to memory, I just have this very vivid memory of me holding the rosemary and remembering this family trip I took when I don't know, around 8, out to Colorado, and I rode a horse for maybe the first time, and I don't know if there was rosemary around there, but the smell of this rosemary brought that back just so vividly.
Huh. But did you call out and say, I can smell again? Or were you more suspicious, more cautious, I guess?
Well, I knew that I couldn't smell the other things around me. So I think I always thought of it as just, this smell has come back right now. And the fact that something had come back was so hopeful that I was really excited.
So what happened?
I don't know what came next, but slowly, very slowly, I started to be able to smell some things sometimes. And the first strong smells, besides rosemary, were chocolate and wine in pretty close succession, which I found fascinating because those are some of my favorite things.
Did you get coffee back?
That came eventually, yeah. That was one of the first, in the first wave of smells. I mean, for smells that come back now, sometimes they're incredibly strong and sometimes they're weak. And sometimes when something is very strong, like coffee, a few months ago, I had this fresh ground coffee and I was sitting on the subway and it was on a bag at my feet and I couldn't concentrate because it's all I could smell. And that's happened before with garlic and, oddly, cucumbers. It's like sometimes my olfactory senses just go haywire and it picks things up crazily.
I'm Dick Gordon. You're listening to The Story. Molly Birnbaum is estimating that over the past year, she's been able to recover about 60% of the smells that she can recognize. And for the longest time, it was only pleasant smells, but then that changed.
I was walking out of my office, and there was a pile of rotting trash outside the door. And I remember just standing there kind of dumbfounded in front of it for a while because it was such an unfamiliar smell because it had been so long since I smelled anything bad. I don't think anyone has ever been so happy to smell rotting garbage. I've noticed that when I am happy, I smell more things. And when I'm sad, I smell almost nothing.
Are you more aware of your sense of smell now? Now that you'd lost it and started to get it back?
Oh, incredibly. Incredibly so. I am much more attuned to the way things smell or to what I can't smell if it could smell. My friends often don't believe me because I'm always talking about something that smells, which they hadn't noticed because they just aren't thinking about it.
I don't think you'll ever take it for granted now.
No, I certainly won't. I mean, it's really changed every aspect of my life. I'm not a chef by any means. I am trying to be a writer now. And I have learned to look at my environment in a different way and to look at how my memories and my emotion are connected to my environment in a way that I had never thought of before this all happened.
So here's a question. If you could wind the clock back to that moment when you're jogging, if you could take that horrible experience out and go back on the line to be a chef again, would you take that?
You know, I don't think that I would. In the end, and many people find it strange, but I'm almost happy that it happened because it's, you know, really challenged me and forced me to take a more difficult, but in the end, I think more rewarding path.
Molly Birnbaum has spent this year earning a master's degree in journalism at Columbia University. She has a job waiting for her in California. Molly's also working on a book about people who have lost their sense of smell. You can look in on more about Molly's story by checking out her blog, and we have links to that at our website. You can find it all at thestory.org. You know, and I think we learn so much by listening to the way that people like Molly make sense of the way that we use our senses or forget about them or rely on them. If you have a story that's similar to that, do get in touch with me. Again, the fastest way is go to the website, thestory.org. Leave me a couple of notes there. I'll be looking for them. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Story.
The Story is a production of North Carolina Public Radio, WUNC, a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill.
American Public Media.